From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
In light of the shareholders' meeting this Friday, we will be demonstrating all around the country to make sure that Abbott changes its policies and that hundreds of thousands of people in Thailand will have access to the life-saving medications they need.
AIDS activists, students from across the country and the world are protesting pharmaceutical company Abbott Laboratories for withholding several AIDS drugs from sale in Thailand. Then Washington goes pink as Code Pink makes its presence known on Capitol Hill.
He is abomination because he wants abomination of Iran. Bomb, 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 bomb Iran. Don't bomb, 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 bomb Iran.
Whether it's protesting John McCain for joking about bombing Iran, staging a sit-in at lawmakers' offices, or holding a banner at a hearing, Code Pink is doing what it can to protest war. We'll speak with founder Medea Benjamin. And Dick Cheney is heading to Utah today to give a commencement address at one of the most conservative schools in the country, Brigham Young University. More than 3,000 students, professors, and alumni at the Mormon school have signed a petition to oppose the selection of the speaker. We'll also talk to a student activist at the University of Maryland leading a fast called Hungry for Peace. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The House has narrowly passed the war funding bill backing a non-binding timetable for withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. The final vote was 218 to 208. This is House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. The Out of Iraq caucus members, including Maxine Waters and Lynn Woolsey of California, voted against the measure. They say they cannot vote for more funding for the war. Anti-war Democrats have also criticized the bill because the timetable is non-binding. On the Republican side, House Minority Leader John Boehner called the bill a measure of surrender.
So we can look up and we can walk out. We can walk out of Iraq, just like we did in Lebanon. Just like we did in Vietnam, just like we did in Somalia, and we will leave chaos in our wake.
This is House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
By placing an unacceptable strain on our military, this war is undermining our ability to protect the American people. Instead of making the American people safer, the war in Iraq has weakened our ability to protect our nation from the threat posed by international terrorism.
A new Wall Street Journal poll shows 56% of Americans now support setting a timetable for withdrawing U.S. troops. The Senate is set for a vote later today. Democrats expect to send the bill to President Bush Tuesday, the fourth anniversary of his infamous speech declaring the Iraq War mission accomplished. The president has promised a veto. Meanwhile, in Iraq, thousands of people marched through Baghdad district of Sadr City Wednesday against the construction of a massive wall dividing Shiite and Sunni neighborhoods. The Pentagon's claim the wall is an Iraqi initiative, but Iraqi officials have denied the charge. This is Shia leader Abdulmehdi al-Matari.
We completely reject the building of any walls on the land of Baghdad and on the land of the entire nation because the walls represent the politics and agenda of the occupiers. The occupiers started by fermenting a sectarian war and currently want to divide the districts of Baghdad in the form of areas or enclaves surrounded by walls with the aim of deepening the divisions between Sunnis and Shiites. We completely reject this.
In other Iraq news, the Los Angeles Times is reporting independent numbers from Iraqi government ministries show at least 5,500 people have died in the Baghdad area alone in the last 3 months. The figure could not be verified as the Iraqi government has refused to release official figures on civilian casualties. Back in the United States, the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee has subpoenaed Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice to testify about the Bush administration's use of pre-war intelligence to lead the country to war with Iraq. This is House Oversight Chair Henry Waxman.
The CIA knew this was all nonsense, and she was informed about it as best I can tell. And how she, as the chief person in charge of intelligence for the President of the United States, couldn't recall? If that's her answer, then let her say it.
Questioning is expected to focus on Rice's personal knowledge of the false claim Iraq had tried to purchase uranium from Niger. Meanwhile, the Oversight Committee has also voted to force the Republican National Committee to hand over documents and testify. The RNC is under scrutiny for the possible illegal use of private email accounts to avoid leaving a paper trail on matters, including the firing of the eight U.S. attorneys. Meanwhile, the House Judiciary Committee has approved an immunity deal for a former key aide to Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. Monica Goodling had vowed to invoke her constitutional right to avoid self-incrimination if forced to testify about her role in the attorney dismissals. The Bush administration has renewed a push to deny Guantanamo prisoners access to their attorneys. In a new filing to a federal appeals court, the Justice Department proposes to allow just three visits for an existing lawyer and one visit for a prospective lawyer. The rules would also deny attorneys access to secret evidence while letting military officials and lawyers read attorney-client mail. The Justice Department says it wants the changes in part because attorney contacts have allowed prisoners to communicate indirectly with the media. It also says lawyers don't have access rights because the prisoners are foreign nationals held in a base in a foreign country. Jonathan Heffetz of the Brennan Center for Justice in New York City said these rules are an effort to restore Guantanamo to its prior status as a legal black hole. In Argentina, two former leaders of the military dictatorship have lost their immunity from prosecution for human rights abuses under their rule. General Jorge Videla and former Admiral Emilio Massera were among the junta leaders from 1976 to 1983. Some 30,000 people died or disappeared. The ruling effectively reinstates a 20-year-old verdict against the two for murdering and torturing dissidents. In Cuba, six dissidents have been released from prison nearly 2 years after they were jailed. The Cuban government had drawn international condemnation after the jailings in the summer of 2005. In Darfur, the African Union peacekeeping force is accusing the Sudanese government of allowing militias to carry out attacks with impunity. This is African Union officer Harry Soka.
Lack of command and control, arms and armor accountability, and the covertly support and from the GOS, the group roams freely within our area of responsibility, threatening, intimidating, and attacking anybody opposed to the GOS interest within the area.
In election news, Arizona Senator John McCain has officially entered the race for the Republican presidential nomination.
We face formidable challenges. I'm not afraid of them. I'm prepared for them. I'm not the youngest candidate, but I am the most experienced.
McCain drew criticism last week for joking about bombing Iran. When asked about whether the U.S. should attack Iran, McCain began singing Bomb, Bomb, Bomb Iran to the tune of the old Beach Boys song Barbara Ann. Meanwhile, another Republican presidential hopeful is coming under criticism for comments on the campaign trail. Earlier this week, former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani said a Democratic win would leave the U.S. at risk for an attack on the scale of 9/11. Democrats have slammed Rudy's remarks. The first Democratic presidential debate is set for tonight in South Carolina. The Wall Street Journal reports Senator Barack Obama has narrowed in on frontrunner Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton. Obama is now 5 percentage points behind Clinton, up from 12 points last month. Former Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz is facing increasing calls to step down as head of the World Bank. The European Parliament has approved a measure calling on Wolfowitz to resign. Wolfowitz has been at the center of controversy after it was exposed he ordered a major pay increase and promotion for his longtime companion, Shahariza. The World Bank's independent oversight agency and a group of 42 former World Bank executives have also charged Wolfowitz to step down. The Bush administration has acknowledged it held at least 20 meetings in government agencies that could have violated federal law restricting partisan activity. The Washington Post is reporting the briefings were part of efforts to brief top appointees on Republicans' electoral prospects and how the election could affect the success of administration policies. Investigators are looking into whether the briefings led appointees to feel pressure to shape decisions around boosting the chances for vulnerable Republican candidates. In California, a federal judge has ruled some aspects of the Los Angeles Police Department's crackdown on low-income downtown neighborhoods is unconstitutional. U.S. District Judge Dean Predigerson says officers have wrongly searched and questioned parolees, probationers, and the homeless without evidence of a crime. The American Civil Liberties Union brought the case after previously winning an injunction against police searches 4 years ago. In an update on a story from earlier this week, Democracy Now! Has obtained footage of Nobel Peace Prize laureate Mairead Maguire after an Israeli soldier shot her with a rubber bullet. Maguire was taking part in a protest against the separation wall near the West Bank village of Bilin. Democracy Now! Producer Anna Nogueira was at the scene. On the tape, Maguire is shot while walking away from the Israeli soldiers. She appears to have been aiding an injured protester. You can go to our website at democracynow.org to see the footage and for our interview with Maguire on Monday's broadcast. And finally, the comedian and actress Rosie O'Donnell is leaving the popular daytime television program The View. O'Donnell says her and ABC could not agree on the terms of a contract extension. The View has seen a sharp boost in ratings during O'Donnell's run. She's drawn controversy for her outspoken comments, including her call for the impeachment of President Bush and her criticism of the Iraq War. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. AIDS activists from around the United States and the world are converging in Illinois on Friday to protest outside the annual shareholders meeting of the pharmaceutical company Abbott Laboratories. Abbott manufactures several leading AIDS drugs but has been embroiled in controversy over its actions in Thailand. Earlier this year, the Thai government announced that it would break Abbott's patent on the AIDS drug Keytruda and begin importing or producing cheaper generic copies of the drug. Under international trade law, countries can issue what's known as compulsory licenses to manufacture or import generic drugs. This can be done without the consent of the foreign patent owner if the country deems it necessary to protect the health and welfare of its citizens.
Abbott responded in a way that shocked many AIDS activists. The company announced it would withhold seven new drugs from sale in Thailand, including a new AIDS drug and treatments for arthritis and high blood pressure. Activists said it was unprecedented for a drug company to withhold medicines from a country over a commercial dispute. The fight between the Thai government and Abbott has been closely watched by AIDS activists and the international medical community. After coming under intense pressure, Abbott appears to be backing down on some of its original threats, but only if Thailand agrees not to break the drug patents. A longtime HIV/AIDS activist from Thailand joins us today from Boston. John Ungbakom is a former senator in Thailand and now serves as the executive secretary of the AIDS Access Foundation in Bangkok. He's been at the forefront of the civil society movement in Thailand to increase access to affordable medicines and improve public health. He's planning to attend the Abbott shareholders meeting on Friday in Chicago. We're also joined by Dr. Joya Mukherjee. She is the medical director of Partners in Health and an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. She has overseen HIV/AIDS treatment programs in Haiti and Rwanda. Anuja Singh is also with us. She's here in New York at our Firehouse studio, a student activist at Columbia University and a member of the Student Global AIDS Campaign. Why don't we begin with John Ungbakom. You are a former senator from Thailand. You've just flown into the United States. Explain why you're here.
I'm here with the chairman of our national network of people living with HIV/AIDS to campaign first for support for the compulsory license that was carried out by the Thai government. By the way, that's not called breaking patents. Compulsory licensing is perfectly legal measure according to the World Trade Organization and the United States and developed countries regularly use compulsory licensing. So there's a lot of misinformation going out about the compulsory licensing in Thailand. We are here to campaign for support for the compulsory licensing by Thailand, which gives access to people living with HIV/AIDS in Thailand. There are 500,000 people to the most important drugs that can save their lives. And we are also here to protest against the action of Abbott of withdrawing important drugs from the market in Thailand. And what Abbott is doing is, in fact, blackmail. It's using patients who need important drugs as hostages. And Abbott is trying to make countries of the developing world afraid to use the legal measures that they can use to bring the prices of the drugs that are needed down so that the patients can get the drugs. Because Abbott wants to protect its interests and keep the prices of its drugs at a high level, which means that most people in the developing world won't be able to afford those drugs. So what Abbott is doing is, in fact, blackmailing the whole developing world, not just Thailand. And we're here to protest and to ask for support in our struggle against Abbott and to support compulsory licensing in the developing world so that the people who need the drugs can live instead of die. That's what we're here for.
Well, could you tell us a little bit about the negotiations that had been going on previously? We understand that for the past 4 years, the Thai government has been trying to get Abbott to reduce prices on some of these drugs. And this latest move of theirs to offer to reduce some prices, but in exchange for recognition or maintaining of its what it calls its patent rights?
Okay. Can I say first that in Thailand, we have had a long struggle by the civil society activists and people living with HIV/AIDS. Since 1998, we have struggled for access to care, treatment, and essential drugs. We fought for compulsory licensing of DDI in 1999, but were unsuccessful. We then managed to get the government pharmaceutical organization in Thailand to produce the generics at low prices. Then we fought for universal health insurance in Thailand, and that was achieved in the year 2001, meaning that everyone in Thailand can get treatment. But the treatment at first didn't cover the antiretrovirals. We then fought for universal access to antiretrovirals, the first line antiretrovirals, which we achieved in the year 2006. But now we have 120,000 people living with AIDS getting the first line antiretrovirals, and the death rate has dropped by over 70% in Thailand now among people with AIDS. They look forward to a bright future, but now more and more of them will need the second line antiretrovirals, which are the more expensive patented drugs. And the Thai Health Security Office, which is the office that looks after our universal health program, has been negotiating with drug companies for the past 4 years to get the prices down. There have been some achievements, only very slight. For example, Merck reduced the price of efavirenz, which is what the first drug that Thailand carried out compulsory licensing for. They reduced the price by 18%. But at the same time, the Thai currency rose in value by 13%. So in dollar terms, it was a very small reduction. After the compulsory licensing was issued, Merck reduced the price another nearly 40%, which shows that compulsory licensing is successful in bringing the price down.
We're going to break for a minute, yes, and then we're going to come back to this discussion. We're talking with the former Thai senator, John Ungpakon. He's just come into the United States from Thailand. And then we'll be joined by the head of Partners for Health and a Columbia University student to talk about why they're so involved with this issue as they all deal on this day before the Abbott shareholder meeting. Stay with us. Femi Kuti, Stop AIDS, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Our guests are John Ungpakorn, a longtime HIV-AIDS activist, former senator from Thailand, just into the United States on this eve of the Abbott shareholders meeting. Nuja Singh is with us in New York. She's a student at Columbia University. And we're also joined by Dr. Joya Mukherjee, who is medical director for Partners in Health. Dr. Mukherjee, can you explain compulsory licensing?
Yes, I can. The concept of compulsory licensing, and I really want to emphasize what John said, is this is not about breaking a patent, and it's very important that the media not keep using this term, breaking the patent. For each country that signs on to the WTO, part of the language is something called TRIPS, the trade-related aspects of intellectual property. Within that language, governments agree to respect a patent with the caveats that in the setting of a national emergency, they can either issue a compulsory license saying they will make the drug themselves. Usually this is for a price benefit, or they can do parallel importing, saying bringing in a generic version. The government signs on to the WTO with that protection. So when Thailand issues a compulsory license saying they are going to make that product, even though there is a patent, that's not breaking the patent. That's exercising part of the TRIPS language. So the compulsory license said that Thailand, their government, will, for government use in the public sector, they will be producing that product generically. The other, like I said, stipulation is parallel importing. And interestingly, in the United States, after the terrible tragedy of 9/11, we said that, in fact, our President Bush said that we would issue, we would parallel import the generic version of ciprofloxacin for the anthrax epidemic and the anthrax problem that we had, which killed only 6 people. So governments often exercise these parallel importing and compulsory licensing in the setting of what people consider a national emergency. Now, if we considered 6 cases of anthrax a national emergency, of course a country like Thailand or places that I work, like Haiti and Lesotho, Rwanda, Malawi, would consider the hundreds of thousands of people in desperate need of antiretrovirals a national emergency, and certainly a fitting setting to invoke a parallel importing or compulsory licensing. So that is all that Thailand is doing. Thailand, South Africa, India, Brazil are in unique situations for poor countries with AIDS because they have a pharmaceutical industry. And so this is extremely important to the countries where I work, like Haiti and Rwanda and Malawi, which do not have pharmaceutical industries. And so we rely on invoking the TRIPS legislation to do parallel importing of generic products that are made in countries that are able to produce them. So Thailand was issuing a compulsory license not for export, only for national use, government use, which is fully allowable under the WTO.
Well, Doctor, what about the argument of Abbott and some of the other drug makers that the invoking of that right under the WTO was meant largely for pandemics or immediate emergencies and not for long-term, even though there are huge medical problems like AIDS?
Well, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find any person that does not consider AIDS a pandemic. I mean, a pandemic is something that affects the entire world and at higher rates than we ever expected, and certainly AIDS is a pandemic. And, you know, for people living with AIDS in any country, whether it's Thailand, where the percentage is lower than, say, South Africa, it's still at epidemic proportions. So I think it would be very hard to say that AIDS is not a pandemic. And in fact, we were successful. The people who care about AIDS, people who are living with AIDS, and the activists about AIDS were successful in Doha, Qatar, in really enforcing this TRIPS language, precisely because the United States had said we have a national emergency here with our few handful of cases of anthrax. So I think every country, as part of our national sovereignty, gets to decide what is an emergency situation and what is a pandemic situation. And so I think that they are wrongheaded, that this is part of national sovereignty, and countries like Brazil and Thailand that have taken a progressive approach to producing drugs for their people have actually been able to decrease, as John said, mortality significantly by producing drugs and using the possibility of a compulsory license as a negotiating strategy.
We invited Abbott Laboratories to join us on the program. They declined our offer. But the Abbott spokesperson, Jennifer Smoter, issued the following comment. She said that Abbott's Ritonavir is priced lower than any generic in the world, including Thailand. She said it's also the only version that's proven quality via WHO pre-certification. There are no generics with this standing. She said the compulsory license action and subsequent statements by the Thai Minister of Health show they've chosen to provide generics to Thai patients with no intent to purchase the medicine. She says, why does anyone care if Abbott resubmits the application? And she says, if the activist's intent is protecting patients, when today the Thai government can have the lowest price for the highest quality new Lopinavir, Ritonavir tablets, why are activists protesting Abbott?
Can I comment on that?
Yes, go ahead.
That's completely misleading. Thailand has bought at least 18,000 bottles of Kaletra, which is not the heat stable, it's the soft gel form of Lopinavir and Ritonavir, and has spent a lot of money on it. The compulsory license is to allow Thailand now to get it at a much cheaper price. And Abbott was selling it at well over $2,000 per patient per year prior to the compulsory license. It's only after Thailand issued the compulsory license that Abbott has brought down the price to $1,000 for middle-income countries and $500 for low-income countries. The generics now, companies are offering it to Thailand for $600 per patient per year. It's Thailand's compulsory license that has made Abbott have to bring down their price. Before the compulsory license, Abbott never agreed to bring the price down that far. So what she's saying is completely misleading. Not only that, but Abbott has actually withdrawn the registration of Alluvia, the heat-stable form, which is needed in countries with hot climates like Thailand. Thailand. So Abbott has brought down the price, but they are not allowing Thailand to get the best form of the drug, Keytruda. So what she is stating is completely misleading.
And can I add that it's cynical in its wording?
Dr. Mukherjee.
Yes, it's cynical in its wording. I mean, what she's saying is today they could get the best price today and that no generic is pre-qualified. Well, this is precisely because of the barriers that these companies are putting up to people using compulsory licensing. So, I mean, what we have to look at with the AIDS pandemic is the long term, as Juan mentioned. This is not a disease that we only think about today. We think about 5 years and 10 years. And when generics came into the market for antiretrovirals, for first-line antiretrovirals, the price dropped 100-fold. I mean, this kind of price drop in just 5 years has allowed us in Haiti, for example, to scale up from 75 patients to 5,000 over the two projects, Partners in Health and Gescio. So, you know, without the generic competition, without generics coming onto the market, today is not meaningful to us. 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. That's how long we expect people to live with HIV and live well.
And Dr. Mukherjee, how important is this particular battle now with Abbott and Thailand? Our understanding is, for instance, other nations, the Philippines, Indonesia, are also considering watching this particular battle and deciding their policies in some terms of some of these generic drugs. Could you put this battle in the context worldwide?
It's extremely important. It's extremely important. And I thank so much John and the other Thai network of solidarity. It's extremely important for countries that have the possibility of manufacturing these drugs, like Brazil, like South Africa, and some of the countries you mentioned, the Philippines, Indonesia. And it's also extremely important for those of us who are struggling in countries that will never be able to make these drugs, but will rely on generic formulations. So, we have to say that companies that produce drugs, there is part of their work that is service. And if you're making widgets, perhaps you don't have to bring your price down on widgets for compassionate use. But on the other hand, you know, these companies are making enormous profits. And, you know, as long as rich people have these diseases, the profits will exist for these companies. And we have to really think about poor people who are really suffering and will die without access to these drugs.
I want to bring into the conversation Anuja Singh. This weekend I was in Chicago and I met with a number of medical students in Chicago from many of the different medical schools there. It was this group that brought my attention to this struggle, and they're very active on this issue. Anuja Singh is a student at Columbia University and a member of the Student Global AIDS Campaign. Why is this an issue that medical students you're not a medical student, you're a university student, Columbia undergrad. Why is this an issue that you have taken on?
I think this issue is one that appeals to students all across the United States that, to a large degree, aren't directly affected by the disease. And because the disease so largely affects people in the global south, may not even know that many people who are directly affected by the disease. But the issues of a common humanity, of solidarity with people around the world, are so strong that it really does compel people to act. Abbott is a company that has been making, in the last few years, over 50% profit. It is not a company that cannot go on without, you know, having people in Thailand, in Guatemala, in these middle-income countries have access to these medications. As Dr. Mukherjee said, this is an issue of essential medications. When medications are available for pennies and we do not value lives over those pennies, that is an issue for huge action. And I think students have really mobilized around this. I think also the idea that AIDS affects people who are the most disempowered, it affects people who are in the global south, who are politically disempowered, economically disempowered, socially disempowered, and affects women so much more than men. All of these come together in AIDS and really works on the vulnerabilities that people feel. And that really has compelled me, and I think a lot of people to take action on this issue.
And on campus, what specifically have you been involved in or doing, and what will you be doing over the next few weeks in terms of this campaign?
Over the last year or so, as the Abbott campaign has developed with ESCAC, it's been part of a larger treatment access campaign. And Abbott has been one of our key targets because of its policies, which have been historic. It's been with Kaletra and also in the past. And we've started off in the very beginning with faxes, with emails, with online petitions, with really those grassroots mobilizing tools that have been very successful in getting the attention of Abbott and showing them that there is a constituency internationally and in the United States that does care about their policies and is willing to act. And today, as well as in with the shareholders meeting tomorrow, there's going to be actions on campuses throughout the country based on the idea of the crime scene, with the idea that Abbott's actions are actually criminal against the people of Thailand, and they need to be stopped. There's going to be calls made to people that are leaders in Abbott, encouraging them to consider the actions that they're taking and to improve their policies so that they don't put pennies over the lives of the people. In addition to the actions that are going on campuses, there's going to be actions taking places at Abbott facilities. For example, in Worcester, Massachusetts, there's going to be a coalition of the American Medical Students Association, the Student Global AIDS Campaign, people living with AIDS, and the Thai activists are going to be joining them in going to the Abbott facilities there and presenting them with a prescription for Kaletra in Thailand. Since they're not getting in Thailand, the idea is maybe if they give this prescription to the people in Abbott where they're actually manufacturing it, they'll maybe have some sympathy and provide these medications.
Yesterday, this report from Associated Press, Brazil said that it is going to strip, Brazil says it's going to strip the patent on an anti-AIDS drug produced by Merck Corporation. Do you think these kind of actions are leading to effects beyond Abbott?
I think that when...
the company, I should say, doesn't offer Latin America's largest country a deeper discount.
Yeah, I think these, as was mentioned previously, the role of compulsory licenses is crucial here. And if they don't offer the lower prices, that's going to affect hundreds of thousands of people. But as was mentioned previously, the compulsory license in itself is a really important right that countries have and has the power in itself to bring down the prices far beyond what the companies are often willing to do. There's the marginal cost of production that's so much lower than what the companies are willing often to offer. And because the markets are so largely in Europe and the United States and in some other highly developed countries, this often does not make sense. So the ability to do a compulsory license and bring down this price significantly is very important.
When did you start your activism, Anuja?
I started in a little bit before my freshman year in college.
Why on this issue?
This issue really appeals to me because I really think that it acts on a nexus of vulnerabilities and really acts on those who are most disempowered in a way that is just appalling. And it also appeals to me because I really think we do have the tools to address it. And because of things like profits with corporations and not having the proper prevention techniques, we're simply not doing it. Because the tools are so available and the injustices are so stark, I think that's what brought me into this.
Have you approached yet the whole issue of the Columbia University obviously has a huge investment portfolio.
Yes.
I'm sure they have quite a bit of Abbott investment as well. Have you approached the issue of the university's investment policies?
Definitely. Definitely, actually. The university has a meeting every year on socially responsible investing, and the Columbia chapter of the Student Global AIDS Campaign has regularly attended that and made a statement on the university's investment policies, specifically regarding its pharmaceutical investments.
Well, we're going to leave it there. I want to thank you very much, Anuja Singh, for being with us, as well as our guests in Boston, John Angvakhan, as well as Dr. Joya Mukherjee of Partners in Health. We'll continue to follow this issue and see what happens at the shareholders meeting, the Abbott shareholders meeting tomorrow in Chicago. We're going to continue looking at student activism, and we're going to talk with Medea Benjamin about the Capitol going pink. Stay with us. Patti Smith, People Have the Power, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. You may have seen them on TV recently, women dressed in pink protesting at a congressional hearing, maybe crashing a press conference or unfurling a banner on the steps of the Capitol. They're called Code Pink, a women's grassroots peace movement that's working to end the war in Iraq, and they're making their presence known in Washington. At the Alberto Gonzalez Senate hearing last week, Code Pink was in attendance. Some of them wore orange prison jumpsuits with black hoods. Others wore their standard pink. They all held up signs that said simply, resign. As Gonzalez shook hands with committee members after the hearing ended, they treated him to a version of the song, Nana Hey Hey Goodbye.
In that old
Speaking of singing, Code Pink also had a response to Republican presidential candidate John McCain when he joked about bombing Iran. This is how McCain responded to a question from a voter in South Carolina recently when asked whether the U.S. should attack Iran.
In that old Beach Boys song, Bomb Iran? You know, bomb, 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 bomb. Anyway.
Well, Code Pink was outside McCain's office the next day with a song of their own.
Oh, John McCain, he is insane. John McCain, he'll wipe out a generation if he gets the bomb nation of Iran. Bomb, 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 Iran. Don't bomb, 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 Iran. Don't bomb, 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 Iran.
Code Pink has also been staging sit-ins at the offices of lawmakers from both sides of the aisle. They recently poured into Democratic Senator Hillary Clinton's office, along with Reverend Billy, to protest the continued funding of the war. Well, the founder of Code Pink, Medea Benjamin, joins us now from Washington, D.C. She's a longtime peace activist and also co-founder of Global Exchange. Welcome, Medea, to Democracy Now! You are changing the face, in a sense, of lobbying in Washington. Explain what you're doing.
Well, these hearings that are going on every day, Amy, they used to be very staid gatherings where you'd have the K Street lobbyists and you'd have the staff aides and maybe a sprinkling of tourists. Now you have Code Pink lining up early in the morning to get into each of the hearings and turning them into really public affairs. We try to participate in them. We certainly participate with our messages on our bodies. When we can get away with it, we participate with signs. And we often get carried away when we hear them saying things we don't like and get up and say something. Sometimes get kicked out, sometimes get arrested, sometimes get tolerated. But we've really turned them into public gatherings, which I think they should be. Yesterday when General Petraeus did a hearing behind closed doors, we were outside there yelling, let the public in, the public wants to hear. And so I think we're really changing the face of the way the proceedings are going on in Congress and demanding a lot more transparency.
Medea, given the number of times you've been ejected in recent months from Congress, you must be probably the best known security question for the security guards there. Are they watching you and following you constantly?
They're actually become our friends. We're on a first-name basis. When we enter the Capitol buildings, they usually get on their walkie-talkie and say, okay, Code Pink is here. They follow us around. They go to have lunch with us. They're really quite nice to us and quite sympathetic to our cause, as are a lot of the people that we find in these hearings. Things are really changing in Washington, and they're changing because groups like ours are keeping the pressure on. And one thing I really want to say to your listening audience is that we need more of you here. We have rented a house, a Code Pink house with 5 bedrooms. We're encouraging people to come from all over the country, stay with us for a week or 2 weeks. There's people who've left their jobs and are really determined to be on the Hill during all of these discussions about supplemental money. So we need more people to come to Washington, get up in the morning with us, go out to these hearings, let them see that the people are determined to end the war in Iraq and not start another one in Iran.
We also see you on C-SPAN just behind the speakers, whether it's a hearing or a news conference. How is that working?
Well, we try to position ourselves right behind the speakers, not because we want the publicity, but because we want the public to see that people are protesting. We want the world to see it. I mean, oftentimes we get called from people in Europe and people in the Middle East, and they say, you know, we saw you there with a sign that says no extraordinary rendition or close Guantanamo, and that warms our hearts to know that Americans care about these issues. So we feel that this kind of public protest is important for our profile as Americans around the world.
And what's been the reaction of the new leadership in the House and Senate, the Democratic leadership? Are they equally chagrined at your activities, or are they half winking at it?
Well, actually, most of us, I think, really appreciate our presence there. We have people that come up and whisper in our ears, keep it up or build up the pressure. We need more pressure. We've been putting a lot of pressure on Nancy Pelosi, not only in Washington, D.C., but back home in San Francisco, with Code Pink women literally camping out outside her door. And we have people coming up and whispering, you know, the pressure is what's needed. Keep it up. So I think some of them might act like they are a little bit angry at us sometimes, telling us to put down our signs or feeling like they have to ask us to leave the hearing room. But I do think a lot of them agree that public pressure is what's going to end this war.
Medea, I wanted to turn to the issue of impeachment. Yesterday, the Vermont House voted down a resolution to impeach President Bush. The Vermont Senate had passed the resolution a week earlier. This is Vermont Senate President Pro Tem Peter Shumlin speaking in the State House yesterday.
I cannot think of a better way to get to the bottom of the investigations of who said what when, who lied to the American people and to the world when, than to put George Bush and Dick Cheney and the rest of the gang under oath and simply ask them those questions. That's what impeachment hearings would accomplish. Vermont has led the way so many times. We were the first state in the country to abolish slavery when that was long overdue. We were the first state in the country to take seriously protecting our natural resources when that was long overdue. We were the first state in the country to stand up for the civil rights of all Vermonters by passing civil unions and inventing it when that was long overdue. And I say that the work that you're doing here today will help Vermont to be the first state in the country that leads the way to the most destructive and deceptive administration in American history. And I thank you for that.
Peter Shumlin, the Vermont Senate President Pro Tem. Medea, you are one of those who is calling for impeachment. Can you talk about that movement? It's something the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says is off the table.
Well, yes, we were very excited when Dennis Kucinich introduced articles of impeachment against Dick Cheney. We were very excited yesterday when a group of people from around the country came together on the steps of the Capitol to also call for impeachment. And in the last 2 days, we've been going around to members of Congress and asking them to support Dennis Kucinich in his resolution 333. And it's interesting to see the response, because there are many progressives who don't want to talk about impeachment. So once again, it's going to be from the grassroots, whether it's from the state houses in places like Vermont, or it's going to be us pressuring our individual congresspeople to join Dennis Kucinich. It's going to have to come from the grassroots. So once again, I say, join us in Washington. You can go on the website codepinkalert.org and sign up to be part of the Code Pink House, and that way you can go to Congress with us every day. And if you believe in impeachment, go inside their offices, sit in their offices, corner them in the lobbies, in the hallways, in the bathrooms, and say, join Dennis Kucinich in this impeachment effort.
Medea Benjamin, thanks so much for being with us, founder of Code Pink, speaking to us from Washington, D.C., where she is doing her activist lobbying every day. And now they have a house where people are staying to go to the Hill every day. We're going to continue on the issue of student activism now. Vice President Dick Cheney's heading to Utah today to give a commencement address at one of the most conservative schools in the country, Brigham Young University. Up until recently, no political protests had been at the Mormon school in years.
Well, that all changed when the school announced this year's commencement speaker. 3,000 students, professors, alumni, and church members have signed a petition opposing the selection of Cheney and the decision to award him an honorary doctorate. Anti-Cheney protests have also been held. And tonight, student activists are planning to hold an alternative commencement featuring Ralph Nader.
Joe Vogel joins us on the phone right now. He's a graduate student at BYU. He's also the author of the book Free Speech 101, The Utah Valley Uproar Over Michael Moore. But let's talk about Dick Cheney right now, Joe Vogel. What's happening? How did Dick Cheney end up being the commencement speaker?
Well, we found out about a month ago, and apparently the school had tried to invite President Bush last year, and that invitation didn't work out. And I guess the White House contacted the school and said that Dick Cheney was available, and the Board of Trustees at BYU, which is the first presidency of the LDS Church, extended the invitation.
And the degree of student and faculty support at such a conservative university, how did that develop?
Well, it's certainly been an issue. BYU has been noted as a very conservative institution for a long time, but there has been a significant backlash to this decision from both students and faculty who really don't feel that, you know, the religious values that BYU espouses, they don't feel that Dick Cheney in any way represents those values.
Can you talk about what happened April 4th, the protests there, and then what is planned for tonight?
Well, on April 4th, we had the first political protest on BYU campus in 15 years. And it was really, for me as a student, it was a really inspiring thing to see. There were 300 or 400 students and faculty out there, and basically showing that even here in the reddest campus, in the reddest county, in the reddest state, there are still people who are deeply disappointed in the leadership of the vice president and his policies and actions over the last several years. And so I think it was a pretty powerful demonstration that even here in Utah Valley, that's the case. Today, there's going to be a lot of things going on. There's a peace sit-in. There's several groups coming down from Salt Lake City. There's going to be quite a few protests. There's going to be people calling for his impeachment. And then I'm part of a group that has organized an alternative commencement ceremony for those students who don't feel represented by Dick Cheney, who feel disappointed that they've worked hard their whole tenure here at BYU, and then the culminating experience is Dick Cheney. So we've provided an alternative commencement that will feature three excellent speakers, including Jack Healey, a human rights activist, Ralph Nader, and Pete Ashton, who ran for Senate here in Utah last year.
Following the April 4th demonstrations on campus, Adam Barlow, a senior at BYU, had a chance to question BYU's president, Cecil Samuelson, about how the protesters were treated. Let's hear what he asked.
This is a wonderful demonstration of the opportunity the students have to enter in dialogue with the administration. I was going to say, yesterday the Dick Cheney protest, it was limited to a small orange square. And then as soon as the clock struck one, very large men in suits started intimidating students and functionally confiscating their signs. I made my own signs, and I was physically intimidated into turning them in, and I wasn't allowed to carry my sign home through campus. My question is, why, as an institution of higher learning, does the university so severely limit free speech, and what is the school so afraid of?
The school is not afraid of anything, Adam. Thank you for your input. Next question.
And we're going to turn now to, as we end today's broadcast, another story on student activism. Students at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, are beginning a five-day fast Monday to protest the war in Iraq. It's being called Hungry for Peace. A number of other campuses are staging similar fasts. Sergio Espana is with us. He's a student organizer at the University of Maryland. Can you talk in this last minute, Sergio, about what you're doing at the University of Maryland?
So we're having students and faculty having a fast and a sit-out for 5 days protesting the illegal U.S. occupation in Iraq. Every day of the fast will represent roughly 100,000 of the more than 500,000 Iraqi civilians that have died as a direct consequence of this illegal occupation. We will also have a lecture series. Now, across the nation, thanks in large part to the Student Peace Action Network, we've had universities from California to Vermont who will also be contributing. So these fasts are nationwide. For example, in Minnesota, apart from the fast, there will also be rallies going into their congressional representatives, turning in petitions, letting them know that the American public wants them to do the job that they were actually elected to do, which is to, you know, support the American public, support the troops, and to end this immoral and atrocious war.
And how has student support been growing against the war in Iraq?
Well, the growth has been tremendous. The real sadness is that the anti-war movement has been strong since before the war actually started. For well over 5 years, students and peace activists across the country have engaged in protests, call-ins, letter writings, and so on and so forth. Yet our elected officials fail to do what the majority of the American public want them to do. So now we feel that we have no choice but to up the ante and to actually partially sacrifice our bodies. And if that's what it takes to galvanize our elected officials, then we are willing to make that sacrifice, one that is extremely minute when compared to the hundreds of thousands of lives that have been taken because of this illegal occupation.
Sergio, what is the response of the administration, and how many students do you think will be involved?
Well, so far the administration is comfortable with it. And as for students being involved, we have that just on our campus that are going to be doing it week long. We have 8 and a couple of faculty members, but that are going to be fasting throughout the course of the week. We have well over 20.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Sergio Espana, student at University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and one of the organizers of next week's Hungry for Peace fast. That does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Aaron Mate, Jen Utes, Mike DeFilippo, Nick Marsilio, Miguel Nogueira, our engineers. Also thanks to Angela Alston, Becca Staley, Hugh Grant, Tyshawn Black, John Randolph, Kieran Krug-Meadows, Tori Townsend, Nicole Salazar, Samantha Chamblee. You can go to our website to get a DVD of today's broadcast at democracynow.org. On Saturday at 4 o'clock, I'll be at UCLA in Los Angeles for the LA Times Festival of Books. You can go to our website for more information. Again, that website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!